On the Empire Podcast this week, is there a Dr. House in a house? Yes, the great Hugh Laurie, star of Blackadder House and now Tomorrowland, colon, A World Beyond, is this week's guest, plus all usual movie news and nonsense on the movie podcast that, if all goes well and our bid of £4.50 and a tattered copy of X-Men Origins Wolverine is accepted, will be permanently joined next week by Raheem Sterling. Only a matter of time. Exciting stuff. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. As ever, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning this week. Helen O'Hara's on holiday, so it's a bonanza of lad bants that may just bag us the job presenting the new Top Gear. First up is our very own Jeremy Clarkson. He's a thunderingly right-wing, bolshy, overly talkative guy with opinions about important stuff that would make your hair stand on end. It's James Dyer.
Hello, Chris.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. Good. How are you?
I'm good. You raised your eyebrows at the Raheem Sterling reference because you do not know who or what that is, do you?
He's actually a very accomplished director. His work is little known, but I've always been a fan.
All right. Okay. That's leave it at that.
Footballerist, isn't he?
Next up is our very own Richard Hamster Hammond. He's cheeky, youthful, irrepressible, armed with facts and a lovely bouncy hairdo. It's Ali Plum.
I'm so James May.
You're not James May, mate. You're not.
You're James
that
May.
I'm James May.
You just don't want to be Hammond, do you?
Nobody wants to be Hammond.
You are Hammond.
Which is really weird because, you know, he's a little cheeky chappy and he's got opinions and he's tiny and he's got good hair and nearly died and everyone loves him except for the people who don't. And yeah, why don't you want to be Richard Hammond, man?
He's short.
And you're so tall.
Correct.
Nevertheless, you're Richard Hammond for the purposes of this, which makes me the cuddly, avuncular, possessed of a biting wit, and let's be honest, a bit of a belly, James May, the housewife's choice, if you will. I'm perfectly willing to accept that mantle here on the Empire Podcast, which this week, I should point out, is once again sponsored by Squarespace. And here comes the blurb. The all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial of Squarespace, not like a murder trial or anything, for a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com. Squarespace.com. Use the offer code EMPIRE. In case you've forgotten what that is, this is the Empire Podcast, so EMPIRE. There you go. It's all very exciting. All right, we've got a question. It has been sent in via Twitter. But before we get into that question, I'm going to address something that people have been raising on Twitter. People have been asking, are we going to do a Mad Max Fury Road spoiler special podcast? The answer at the moment is no. And the reason for that is that we don't do them unless we talk to the filmmaker, because then they shed light on stuff and it's interesting to talk around and, you know, brings you things that you haven't heard about the film, rather than just four idiots in a room talking about the movie, which is essentially what the Mad Max spoiler podcast would be. George Miller did not come to the UK, therefore we were not able to interview him. So at the moment, as things stand, that's our policy. We've only done it once before for Skyfall, and that was 3 years ago, and we were still kind of finding our feet. That's the policy at the moment. If you feel violently, really strongly that we should have a Mad Max Fury Road spoiler special, do let us know if that disappoints you, if you want to hear us talking about torques and camshafts and all sorts of stuff, then, you know, who knows? We may reverse that decision. Reverse, because it's a car chase.
We can adopt our Top Gear personas.
Top Gear persona. This week, we have a question. Some say he's at Matt Bunk, and he is, and he sent in a question, which is, you have to remake only one film of a trilogy, says Matt Bunk. One rule, you can't say The Godfather 3, it's too easy. Oh, that's harsh.
That is harsh.
It is harsh. And are we extending this? We just keep this in trilogies, right? We're not extending this to the Friday the 13th series or the anything that's gone beyond three.
Stick it to trilogy. But then, of course, there's a difference between, a proper trilogy and just like a threequel.
Yeah, does Alien 3 count?
Well, no, because it goes on after that. I think if it stops with three, you can get away with it. Personally, yeah. I would probably remake An Unexpected Journey, and I would have it continue beyond the Shire, cover the end of Smaug, and indeed the Battle of the Five Armies, and then, you know, finish, because I think it would have been a much better tale told as a single film.
So your idea to remake a trilogy is to
combine it into one
scrap
film.
The trilogy.
Yeah, basically.
That's kind of interesting. That series would have worked better as two. I think everyone can agree on that one. It's kind of always the third one, isn't it? It's usually always the third part. That, you know, so if it is Godfather 3, it is
Blade Trinity.
It is Blade Trinity.
It's Naked Gun 33 and a third.
It is Naked Gun 33 and a third. Usually they do botch up the third part.
Yeah. The Raimi Spider-Man trilogy, third one.
Yeah, absolutely. That's probably one I'd have a go at, because if anyone knows how to make the third part of the Spider-Man trilogy, it's me, Podcast Muggins here.
Yes. James May.
James May with my, love of toys and, my
Yams.
Hair.
Ooh. Matrix Revolutions.
Yes.
That is a good shout, actually.
I think there's a lot that they could have saved. I feel like there was an opportunity lost. All the mythos, and I feel like it dropped the ball.
I wonder if it isn't even more straightforward than that. The thing I always found with the Matrix films is inside the Matrix, it's really interesting. Outside the Matrix, it's quite dull. And the third film has just token Matrix scenes, and then the rest of it's all in Zion, and it's just quite boring once you get out of the simulation.
Yeah, I like elements of the Matrix Revolutions, but then I like elements of the Godfather 3.
So do I.
So what do I know? But is there a part 3 that's better than part 2? Some people would say Back to the Future 3 is better than Back to the Future 2.
They would be wrong.
What about Indiana Jones? Is the third better than... Of course, this isn't a trilogy anymore, so what are we saying?
No, but it is better than the second one.
It is a trilogy, because they didn't make a fourth.
No, he's right. There are only three Indiana Jones films.
We know this.
Yeah. So I would say that the third is better than the second Indiana Jones.
But personally, not better than the first.
There you go.
So you would remake Temple of Doom?
I don't want to remake any of them. That's why it's a tough question. Mm. But yes, I would remake the second.
Okay. Why is that?
I don't like the grabbing the stone breasts, going back and forth from the bedroom scenes. Her character generally isn't for me.
Also, there are overtones now in that movie that are, when you watch it as a kid, you're going, okay, that's fine. Then you watch it as an adult and you go, oh, this is kind of racist. this is, I'm not very comfortable with this. Get him, Indy, I guess. It's kind of, okay, this is weird.
But still, at the same point, there's so much to love in that film. Like, yeah, it is 95% fantastic. Shorthand's fantastic. I love him. And
yeah,
the minecart chase, rope bridge, and it goes on and on and on. It's great. But if I had to pick one.
If you had to pick one, it would be that one. I don't know if I'd remake one film in a trilogy, but I would address what I think is one of the biggest flaws of a trilogy, and I would recast Anakin Skywalker across the entire prequel trilogy. Because that is just the worst casting.
Both times.
Mm. Hamstrung by poor character development and bad dialogue, yes. But when Harrison Ford said, you can type the ship, but you sure can't say it, he could say it.
He managed it.
He managed it, and he elevated that material. And Jake Lloyd, God rest his soul, and Hayden Christensen are just awful. Awful in those movies. And I also wonder, George at one point was talking about, he started off, George Lucas, by the way, sorry, in case anyone didn't know who George was. He was talking about at one point about making Anakin 12 in The Phantom Menace. And I kind of feel that would have been more interesting than a little boy who actually doesn't know how to pilot a starship and says yippee a lot and wants a smack.
Yeah, he's one of the most aggravating screen characters, I think. And it's heartbreaking, isn't it? Because, I mean, you got that fantastic teaser poster, which was Jake Lloyd with the sort of the shadow of Vader behind him to sort of emphasize that this will be Vader. And then you see him and you've just brutally emasculated cinema's greatest villain. Mm. And it's horrendous. It's just horrendous.
I'm blaming him for midichlorians as well.
Yeah, midichlorians, and frankly, at the end of Revenge of the Sith, it's just, I mean, having anyone who follows me on Twitter will know that I sat through the prequels again a few weeks ago, and I have long, as have you indeed, been a defender of the prequels, and I have been forced to do a slight 180 on this particular
a slight 180.
A slight redaction.
A screeching handbrake turn.
Yeah, it was a little bit like that, to use another Top Gear analogy.
We're doing all right this
week.
We
are doing quite automotive. Okay. It's good.
Screeching handbrake turn.
That's right. Nice.
Leaving skid marks on the road. In fact, the only way the Phantom Menace could be worse, if it was made by a German. Which, of course, is not.
No, it's not.
Hello, American listeners.
Americans love Top Gear, man.
They do. It's our best export.
Americans love it. They're distraught about Clarkson in America. probably. I don't know. I would also say one other thing that I would do, which is, again, completely changing the question for our own end, is I wouldn't necessarily want to remake a movie in a trilogy that exists. I'd maybe want to cap some films at three.
Oh, okay.
Before they go on and tarnish the legacy that goes beyond. And yes, we joke all the time on this about there not being a fourth Indiana Jones film, but that's a good case in point. I would, with the best will in the world, because I love the man and I love his work, but I would go to George Romero and I'd go, don't make Land of the Dead, and certainly don't make the films that came after that, because it tarnishes your legacy. Land of the Dead's okay, it's fine, but the first three are masterpieces, and what came afterwards, there's not a single masterpiece to be found, sadly. So I would stop at three dead films, and I'd go to the makers of Police Academy, and I'd say stop at five, guys.
Yeah, you really hit your high point at five.
You do hit high point five.
Which of the Top Gear presenters would you remake? I think it's Clarkson. I think I would start from scratch and just rebuild him with all new parts.
I'm fairly certain the BBC are trying to do that at the moment. So,
yeah, I'm fairly certain they are. Yeah, it's Clarkson, isn't it?
But the opposite of what you were saying earlier is the Fast and Furious franchise, where if they, to be honest, got rid of the first three, maybe the first four, be totally okay with it.
Except for the fact that you're entirely wrong, as the first one is still the best.
You're not, oh, God.
I'm never getting past this.
I'm going
to... You do actually sound like Clarkson saying that.
Thank you. The first one is the best. The second one is average. The third one is average. The fourth one is average. The fifth one is great. The sixth one is average. The seventh one is great.
Okay, there's a lot of wrong things. What you just said. Do you have a business card?
Are you going to do a magic trick?
Does it say professionally wrong on it?
Oh,
because
I see you did that.
It should do. It should do. And if it doesn't, give me some Tippex and I'll make sure it does.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's say, for example, for the sake of saying, just the sake of argument, that we accept the Fast Five is great on its own terms for what it is.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, Fast and Furious, which again, I cannot stress enough, is a Rob Cohen film.
You're going to bring up Cohen.
And is basically not as good as Point Break. Is not great.
No, I know. I have a great deal of affection for the original Fast and the Furious. It is a very different beast to the latter films. I think it has metamorphosized into something entirely different, and great in its own way. But I still think the first is the best. Sorry.
Fair enough.
But going back to the question,
yes.
If I were to do one thing, I would go back in time. I would speak to Fox, and I would change the scheduling of X-Men The Last Stand so that it started shooting after Superman Returns had finished.
Yes, or...
Give it a Ratnerectomy.
Would you, well, that's a bigger conversation. I'm not sure that all the faults of X-Men The Last Stand can be pinned on Brett Ratner, to be fair. Because he came in with about 8 weeks to go. And a lot of the things actually were set in stone by Matthew Vaughn. So the death of Cyclops and all that sort of stuff is set in, if you want to attribute blame for Vinnie Jones' casting as a Juggernaut.
I think there's plenty to go around.
There is plenty to go around. Would you actually go one step further and say, Brian, don't make Superman Returns, just make the X-Men movie? Yeah, which it's a film I really, really like. It has a lot of good things in it, but...
Part of a prequel in its own way, part of a trilogy.
I guess you could say that. Yeah, absolutely. It pretends that Superman 3 doesn't exist.
I'd say that would be a trilogy I'd remake. If Superman Returns, I'd remake that.
Uh-huh.
And replace it with Superman 3.
Yes, I'd remake Superman Returns into the exact same as Superman 3.
Nice. I approve.
All right. Okay. Interesting. We had some interesting questions this week that we just don't have time to get to because people are banging on the glass and wanting to kick us out. We will get to them in next week's episode, I promise you. But if you do want to have a question read out in the Empire Podcast, do send it in to us via Twitter. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. You can email us podcast@empireonline.com, and you can Facebook us as well, where we're Empire Magazine. Right, so let's discuss some of this week's movie news. Hollywood's kind of gone easy on us this week. There's not a lot that's out there, but, you know, I'm going to start with something which I think is very, very interesting. Paramount have assembled a franchise writing team that will oversee the Transformers Cinematic Universe.
Huh.
Mm. Yes. So they have a writer's room because Transformers is every studio now in Hollywood is looking at what Marvel have done and have gone, ooh, we want some of that. Gimme the cashola. And so almost every franchise at the moment is now gonna go enter a world of shared universes and spin-offs and solo stories and all sorts of stuff. And Transformers is we're going to be inflicted with some of those. But this is an interesting little writer's room they've put together. So previously, Akiva Goldsman, the Oscar-winning writer of mm-hmm. Batman and Robin, didn't win for Batman and Robin, it has to be said. He signed on to work with Michael Bay, Steven Spielberg, and Lorenzo Di Bonaventura, who's a producer. He's been on how many Transformers movies now, is it?
Eight,
yeah. And they were to create a writer's room to develop more stuff. So now Deadline are reporting that Robert Kirkman, the creator of The Walking Dead, is on board, as is Art Markham and Matt Holloway, who are the writing team who did a lot of early stuff for Marvel, including Iron Man. Jeff Pinkner, who wrote on Fringe and Lost, and Zach Penn, who wrote X-Men The Last Stand, The Incredible Hulk, and a first draft of The Avengers that was not very good from all reports. So that seems to that as I read them out, the names shifted in quality. But what do we think about that? There's actually the Kirkman on this is interesting.
They all seem to be an impressive group of people. Mm. The idea itself seems to work. Okay, so you get some good writers in a room, and they'll come up with good ideas and good scripts, right? Mm-hmm. My trouble is that how do you have this Marvel-style universe in a Transformers universe that presumably they want to carry on, but also have spin-offs and whatever? Can you have the origin story of this robot? Like, is that where do they go?
Would you go see an Optimus Prime movie?
Yeah, well, this is kind of what I'm talking about. And how can the Transformers, being so team-based, if you know anything about them, they're very team-based, mm-hmm. have solo outings? I know the end of 4. Do we want to spoil it?
We can spoil it.
Yeah.
They did a fairly good job of that on their own.
If you haven't watched 4, sorry, he blasts off seemingly into space, Optimus Prime, sword aloft. So is that what they're doing? That he goes into space and there'll be some kind of Guardians of the Galaxy, but with robots? I don't know, but I just don't see how this world will have solo outings. I don't see it.
Unless, of course, it's Stanley Tucci's character from Transformers 4 in a solo outing, just doing paperwork. I watched that. He was the best thing in that movie.
I want Titus Welliver's, and it will be called Face Warrant.
Face Warrant. I'd go and see that film. I think the problem with the Transformers universe is that it's starting from a slightly dodgy position in that everyone kind of liked the first Transformers movie. I still like the first Transformers movie, but what's come since is just 3 awful films. And I just think that you need to start from a greater platform of quality to spin this universe off. It still does gangbusters. The last movie was the biggest hit of last year, grossing over $1 billion. I've just got a feeling that the tide is turning against these movies. And that the waters of public perception, if you dip your toe into them, you just get a feeling, oh, not more Transformers. Oh, what's going on? And I think they actually need to break away from Michael Bay. I think they need to, for want of a better phrase, reboot. I think they just need to start again and hopefully get it right this time.
Let's be honest, though. I mean, what would you do differently? So let's pretend this was a trilogy and let's go back to the original question. What would you do differently with Transformers? How would you make it better?
I'd hire different writers, a different director.
Well, they're on the first bit.
Yeah. It's a difficult question. That's appallingly true. You look at what it is and you go, well, how do you get it perfect? How do you make it both interesting to humans as well as just braying masses, clapping?
They're not, let's be honest, great characters.
No.
They're interesting as toys. Mm. They were always quite slim pastiche characters. I will admit, I mean, the film has taken that to the nth degree with their particular brand of offensive stereotyping. But I don't know that there's a truly great series of films in this property. I think what they had was a truly great film potential, which they semi-realized with the first one. The first one, I thought the robot stuff worked extraordinarily well. I had mixed feelings about you know, John Voight's character, John Turturro's character. I felt like they were in a slightly different film. But you did come out of that in the same way that you came out of Pacific Rim thinking this is a film for which CGI was possibly invented. And there are moments in Transformers where, you know, it's absolute genius. Starscream transforming, spinning around a pole, it's giant robots hitting each other. It's great. But, you know, as a film, that's brilliant. As eight films or whatever it's going to be, it's just fatigue. And, whether it be Revenge of the Fallen or Dark Side of the Moon or, you know, you do get into just robots hitting each other for hours on end and buildings falling down. And it just gets a bit tedious because there's no characterization to back it up.
Yep, I think that's fair enough. Although I would love to see a Transformers movie where all the actors who are in a completely different film to the one that they're in team up and just overact wildly at each other for 2 or 3 hours. That'd be great. Turturro, Foyt, Tucci, Welliver. Get them in.
Welliver should be in everything.
Well, that's a philosophical question that we won't have time to get into. Paramount have asked Edward Zwick, director of The Last Samurai, of course, to work with Tom Cruise again on the second Jack Reacher film, which we think will be based on Never Go Back, the 18th Jack Reacher novel.
Indeed.
Jimbo, like myself, you're a massive Reacher fan. What do you think about this news?
Interesting. I'm in two minds. I think the first film deviated quite wildly from what I see as the Reacherverse, but made it work. You know, it wasn't a Reacher film, but it was a good film in its own right. So I'd be interested to see what Zwick does with this. I won't go so far as to say it's Zwicked, but I'm optimistic.
Never go so far as to say it's Zwicked. Optimistic.
Yeah.
A plums.
Well, let's look at his back catalogue. Ed Zwick's done Blood Diamond, which I think is a great film. Mm-hmm. Last Samurai has its fans. Maybe Love and Other Drugs isn't a good comparison here, but he's made plenty of good films. Defiance, Legend of the Fall, Glory. So, yes, he's got clout. Like, he's a worthy Reacher rounder-upper. No, that didn't work. Anyway, he seems to be a good choice for me, but I just wonder whether there'll be enough people willing to pay the money to go and see the film. How much did the first movie make? It wasn't a poor showing, but it wasn't substantial.
No.
I guess I'm just pleased that there'll be another movie. As James said, the first one was pretty damn decent, and I'd like to see what's going to go on from there. If you disassociate it from Reacher, it's even more enjoyable. Just pretend he's a guy who just sounds like he's called Jack Reacher and seems to be a bit like him, but is kind of totally different. But yeah, it seems interesting. I just hope it gets made.
Same here. I'd like to see a few more of those, to be honest. But what it means is that Chris McQuarrie is not going to be involved. He's going to be executive producer, but he's too busy editing and finishing Mission Impossible Rogue Nation to do that. The Magnificent Seven, which is a movie that I am genuinely hugely excited about, is about to start shooting. And Peter Sarsgaard has signed on to play the movie's main bad guy, which is cool. It's a really interesting cast. So you have Denzel Washington, Chris Pratt, Hayley Bennett, Ethan Hawke, so it's Training Day 2, Wagner Moura, Byung-Hun Lee, Matt Bomer, Vincent D'Onofrio. It's a good cast. That's a solid cast, I think. And D'Onofrio, contrary to reports, is not a baddie. He's one of the Magnificent Seven himself. So I'm excited about this. You think this is going to be good? I
mean, I'll watch anything with D'Onofrio in at the moment. Post Daredevil, I'm a massive D'Onofrio file.
Yeah, I kind of want. It's like he's been kept back in the Jurassic World marketing so much. He's in the new trailer briefly, and I just kind of feel everyone loves him now after Daredevil, and I'd be up in his presence in those trailers and TV spots and going, look, it's Wilson Fisk but with hair. And cool, Ali, do you you agree?
I'm excited. I love Chris Pratt, and I'll watch anything he's in.
Yes, Antoine Fuqua, formerly of this pod booth, is going to be the director of that, which is why it's Training Day 2. Anything else?
Yes, can I throw out a hearty Loktar Ogar for the fact that... it's Warcraft news. That's right. And there's nothing quite like visual news to air on a podcast, and that's that they released the first image of Orgrim Doomhammer from the Duncan Jones Warcraft movie. And I really liked it. I thought he looks great. I mean, to be fair, it's cheating slightly because we saw some footage from the film at Comic-Con last year, so we kind of know what the orcs look like anyway. But this is the first kind of publicity still that they've released. And for those of us who enjoy a game of Warcraft, or indeed a game of Hearthstone.
Nerds! Nerds!
Yes, those of us who are nerds.
God, Chris, they're such massive nerds! Get away from the building!
Oh my God! Guys, have you seen this pot? It's called the Kettle Black.
No, but the point of Warcraft is that one of the reasons behind its success is the aesthetic of Warcraft has always been a slightly cartoony, slightly caricatured one. And I think that was the interesting thing of what they would go for with the film. You know, do you go for Tolkien? Exactly. Yes, my lord. Do you go with sort of Tolkien-esque orcs, which are, for want of a better term, sort of more realistic, more sort of gritty? Or do you go with the slightly, you know, hugely exaggerated, massive arms, tiny heads, kind of slightly caricatured look they go in the games? And I think they've walked this line brilliantly, where they are caricatured. They look very like Warcraft orcs, but they're... They don't quite fall into being sort of a parody. You know what I mean? You can take them seriously. They're believable.
Imposing and real.
They are, yes. And I think it's done a really good job. And I think everyone should go and check out Doomhammer.
So give us a quick 45-second pressy of the film.
Oh, good God.
All I know about this movie is that it's directed by Duncan Jones, which is a good sign, and it's based on a video game that I do not play. So you have 45 seconds. Go.
Okay. The orcs come from a world called Draenor. One of their sort of leader type characters is a warlock called Gul'dan, who gets in league with Manaroth, who's a demon, and forms a coven, and he makes the orcs drink some blood, and they turn mental and evil. Then he opens the dark portal, and then they invade Azeroth, and they start killing humans, which leads us into Warcraft 1, Orcs versus Humans. Lots of other stuff happens later on, which you don't need to worry about. If you play World of Warcraft, and you've played the Warlords of Draenor expansion, then you'll know a lot of this kind of backstory stuff, because it all happens in the past. Now, the main people, Travis Fimmel, who plays Anduin Lothar. He's a king in Azeroth. He's a human. He's a good guy. You've got all other major characters. Garona, who's, I believe, a half-orc assassin. That's Paula Patton's character. Toby Kebbell voices Durotan, who's one of the orcs. He's a good orc. Mm-hmm. As such a thing can exist, and his name is lent to Durotar, which becomes the orcs' homeland in Kalimdor, which is one of the continents in Azeroth. Orgrim Doomhammer, which is voiced by it's Robert Kaczynski's character.
It's mocap, isn't it? Rather than is mocap.
Yeah, it's voice mocap. Yes, you're right. I am, of course, playing down the role of mocap, so I shouldn't do that. Dominic Cooper plays King Lane Rin. He's a king. Sorry, he's a king in Azeroth, I believe. Anduin Lothar, which is Travels Fimmel's character, is kind of a general. He's a military leader. Ben Foster's in. He plays the wizard Medivh, who's quite a prominent character in Warcraft lore. Clancy Brown, of course, the Kurgan himself. He plays Blackhand, who is one of the bad orcs. If you think of some good orcs, some bad orcs, he's a bad orc.
Okay.
And who else is there? Ben Schnetzer, he voices Khadgar. He is, I believe, Medivh's apprentice, I want to say, one of the wizards. And then, of course, there's Terry Notary, who does the voice of Gromash Hellscream.
And again, we should emphasize plays, rather than does the voice.
Does the voice. Sorry, okay. I'm Andy Serkis would slap me around the head. He's banging on the glass. I can see him there. He's looking very angry. Sorry, Andy. yes, he plays Gromash Hellscream. Yes.
Wow.
He's a good orc. So lots of orcs. Gul'dan, who's the warlock, as I mentioned earlier, he's voiced and acted by Daniel Wu.
All right, cool. 45 seconds.
Is that
you
what,
did that in 45 seconds.
Does everyone vaguely
you
now understand?
You took an extra 2 minutes, but that was pretty good.
I think we got up to level 19.
Yeah, I'm still none the wiser. Yeah. But the CG orc looks fantastic. I think it's going to be interesting. And they've pushed this movie back twice, and I think that's definitely helped get the hopefully. The
yeah, it's funny because people were saying, you know, oh, this doesn't bode well. I think it bodes brilliantly that they pushed it back. I think getting the effects right is paramount. So, and they were looking pretty good last summer, what they showed us at Comic-Con. So
absolutely.
Very excited.
Absolutely. One last thing very, very quickly.
For the Horde.
Is anyone here a fan of The Crow in any of its various iterations?
Yes.
So how do you react to news that the upcoming reboot, remake, whatever you want to call it,
yes,
directed by Corin Hardy, who's very, very talented, is looking to cast Andrea Riseborough as Top Dollar?
As Top Dollar, who's the crime boss, for want of a better term. I'm fine with this. I think I'm a fan. I think I'm... It's Alex Proye's film is kind of a cult hit. I mean, lots of people do like it. I know you're not a huge fan, are you?
I need to revisit it. I hated it.
Because
I like Alex Proye's stuff, and I kind of wonder if I should go back and take another look.
Well, it's flawed, but to be fair, they had their fair share of production problems. What with having their main star die. It does feel a little bit like a slightly weird goth rock video, but the soundtrack's fantastic. You know, there's Cure, there's Nine Inch Nails, there's all sorts of kind of crazy stuff on there. I really liked the way they played it out. It's kind of strangely structured like a computer game where it's sort of sub-boss, sub-boss, big boss. You know, he sort of takes them on one by one. But there's, I enjoyed the character of Eric Draven. I thought Brandon Lee played it very, very well and sort of brought a life to it beyond what's in the comic. The comic's a very different beast. It's much, much, much darker. It's much more depressing. I don't know if anyone knows the origin of the Crow, but it's James O'Barr, who wrote the comic, sort of wrote it in response to the death of his then girlfriend. So it's a really, really dark piece of writing, and indeed the way it's illustrated. And it's very different to the film. I mean, Top Dollar, who obviously famously played by Michael Wincott in Pryor's film, is never seen in the comic. So having him slash her played by Andrea Riseborough, I don't think is going to offend any comic aficionados. It's an interesting take. I mean, I think O'Barr's been much more involved in the production of this one, so it probably will hew closer to the source material, which, frankly, could make it quite hard watching.
Yes, but yeah, I'm optimistic.
Yeah.
So we shall see. Ali, do you have any thoughts on this one?
Never seen The Crow.
Never seen The Crow. Perhaps we should revisit it together and, you know, with fresh eyes.
It's a great idea. I like it.
Right, that's the movie news, which means it's time now for this week's guest. Hugh Laurie is a bloody national treasure, and as someone who grew up worshipping a bit of Fry and Laurie, as I know you did too, A-Plums, along with Blackadder, it's a pleasure to have him on the show. Since his early days, of course, in British comedy, he's become a household name in the States, as has Jeremy Clarkson, thanks to his role as Gregory House on House. And he's also an acclaimed jazz musician. I was listening to his second album last night. It's very good. And this week he pops up as the bad guy in Tomorrowland, colon, A World Beyond, opposite George Clooney. I went along to speak to Mr. Laurie earlier this week when he was in London, because he's currently shooting the John le Carré TV show, The Night Manager. And he had one day, his day off, he came in. What a lovely guy. We had a wide-ranging chat about all kinds of things, including, hey,
Top Gear.
Top Gear. Look at that. Look at that. We don't just throw this shit together, you know. Enjoy.
We're delighted to be joined on the Emperor podcast by Hugh Laurie. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I am not too bad, not too bad. A lovely Sunday afternoon. Here we are, stuck in a hotel room. But this is the life we choose, a life
we're in Claridge's hotel. it's a gilded cage.
If it was a travelodge, we might have cause to complain.
Exactly.
I have to say congratulations, first of all, on Tomorrowland. The accent, the British accent, is absolutely spot on.
Thank you.
How many years of research did you spend getting that?
It wasn't quick. Yeah. It doesn't come easily. People think it's something you can just put on like a pair of shoes. It's not like that. Mm. 56 years.
56 years?
Yeah, yeah. But then if you're going to do something, do it right. You know, it's worth doing.
Why a British accent? From 56 years ago, you committed, you decided I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
We're going to do a British accent. Why a British accent? Right?
I thought it was just commercially, it made sense.
Yeah.
I thought I could see a future. Ha ha ha. I could see a future where slightly creepy British people would be used a lot in Hollywood movies.
Yes.
As sort of threats, as menacing, creepy people.
Yes.
And I thought, yes, that's a business I could get into and dominate.
It's only the accent you've been practicing for the last 56 years, not the menacing, creepy
side. How do you know that? You've got no way of knowing that.
It's a hunch.
The fact that I've got away with it, I have escaped the attention of the authorities for this long. Yes. No. I've concentrated. It's the accent mostly. Mm. Yeah.
Do you still have a situation where Americans, in particular, think that you are American after being so convincing in House for?
Yes, I do actually. Yeah. They do look at me as if I'm talking funny, but that I take that as a great, you know, compliment. Not a great compliment. A compliment. It was. But I think the world, it's a different world now. It's interesting because Mad Max is I know that the there's a lot of flurry around the remake of Mad Max at the moment. When the first Mad Max came out, if I remember correctly, they actually dubbed Mel Gibson because they thought American audiences couldn't understand an Australian accent. I think the world is a very different place now. I think Americans and actually world audiences are much more open to hearing different sounds, different dialects, different sort of textures in films. They don't need to have things sort of translated in that sort of rather formal Soviet way into their own speak. You know, they can, and I think that's great. I think people are used to. We're not in that Henry Higgins world anymore. Yes. I hope. Yeah. I think there's a lot more There's a lot more sort of flexibility now, freedom for actors.
That's interesting. As part of my research for this, I was watching a lot of your appearances on the Craig Ferguson show, The Late Late Show, which was I was a huge fan. I used to live in the States for a while. And it's fascinating. You're talking about people acclimatizing to accents. And he never really dialed down the Scottishness, which
he didn't. Although I always thought that he had a slight advantage because a Scottish accent is actually... I mean, I'm no expert in this field, but I think it is actually a component anyway of what wound up being the conventional American accent. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The Scots went over there in big numbers, and there are certain vowel sounds that you actually think, wait a minute, Americans do that, but that's actually sort of straight Glasgow. You know, that's where it came from. That's why they sound. And Irish, too.
Yeah.
The sort of la-di-da... middle-class Englishman has got actually a slightly bigger step to make than Craig Ferguson did.
Yes.
But you're right, he was very... I think that's why they loved him so much, yeah. Because he was not someone who ever tried to explain himself or try and tailor himself to be what people wanted. He did it so much on his own terms that people just responded so well to that. It was so honest and refreshing. And it still is. I mean, he's an incredibly... charming and one, he is a wonderful host, wonderful comedian.
Mm. You've done so many things over the years. I mean, you know, acting, comedy, music as well. Chat show never occurred to you? Is that something that you
being the host?
Being the host, yeah.
I've thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would be absolutely terrible. Terrible.
But that in itself has a strange fascination. I would love to see you be terrible.
I suppose it would actually to have a chat show host who is just notoriously bad at small talk, or even big talk. He is even worse at big talk. So what are we going to talk about? Yeah, that would be quite interesting to see actually. just 30 minutes of straight social awkwardness.
Mm.
That might be. You could actually call it the car crash.
That would be amazing. Yeah. Well, I'm just saying, Top Gear is available. Top Gear is searching for a host at the moment.
So I understand.
I know you maybe prefer two wheels to four, but I'm just throwing it out there.
It's funny because 20 odd years ago, when I did this sketch show with Stephen Fry, and we actually had a sketch in which we bemoaned the fact that car programs all thought that their job was to be funny, and we made the point that we don't on a comedy show we don't review cars, so why can't they just stick to their own? And then we started reviewing the Nissan Micra. Yes, I just don't think that's something I would I would slot into very easily.
The car crashed with Hugh Laurie. You have one viewer, sir.
Well, thank you. Thank you. From tiny acorns, etc.
But let's talk about David Nicks as much as we can, because he's a character that is difficult to talk about without getting into spoiler territory. But he is, as you say, slightly menacing and slightly creepy. Did you take a lot of inspiration from the name David Nicks to Nicks things, Nixonian?
I particularly enjoyed the fact that they took Brad and Damon, who wrote the script, they took the names seriously. The names mattered. Names mean something.
Yeah.
They colour the way people respond to a character in life as in films. There is a negative aspect to him, although not one that I don't think this character would be conscious of. I think he feels that what he is doing is for the best, is mm-hmm. for the good of mankind. Mm-hmm. But there have been throughout history many dictators who have thought precisely that, mm-hmm. that they are doing the best for people. If only people knew what was good for them, they'd understand. That's the sort of mindset of the... your average dictator. But yes, you're right. To enforce that vision on a population, an unwilling population, requires a sort of negative, a sort of, not negative, but a forceful requires a form of discipline. That's a rather sinister word, discipline. but that's what he has. He realizes that this is a vision that he has to impose on people. If it's going to work,
yes,
it has to be imposed. And yes, there is something negative about him in that way.
It's safe to say he's not a very optimistic person. It's a movie about the power of optimism, ultimately. Are you an optimistic person about the future?
I am becoming more so. I'm either becoming more optimistic or I'm becoming more impatient with pessimism. I find pessimism as a sort of default setting, cynicism as a default setting, very sort of wearing, and I have resolved to be jaunty about the future.
Does jauntiness come naturally to you?
No, it's something I do jaunty exercises every morning to increase my jaunt factor. But it is, as the film says, it is a sort of an effort of will that the future is, it sounds trite, but then a lot of true things do sound trite. But the future is what we make it, and the future is determined by the attitude we have as we step into it. I have found myself lately becoming, I think, more rather than less optimistic. I think partly because it may be my own personal fight against the aging process, that I'm determined not to become, you know, Mr. Grumpy of Tunbridge Wells, because I find that so pointless. I just it's so dispiriting, and the end result is a sort of apathy.
Yes.
And that any form of productivity or energy or creative spirit that one has, it requires optimism. It requires a sort of, to hell with the risks, we're just going to do it anyway and see what happens. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. That's not going to intimidate us into not trying things.
It's interesting. I'm one of the many hundreds of thousands of people who follow you on Twitter, and you're not pessimistic on there. You're not. It's very easy to be cynical and snarky on Twitter, and that's a trap that you haven't, thus far, I think, fallen into.
I have come awfully close.
How many times have you deleted tweets?
I have deleted snarky tweets. It is a bit weird. It's like having a loaded gun around the house. You think, oh, one of these days I'm going to accidentally pull the trigger and that's going to go off. I've got to keep making sure that I've emptied the gun. Yes, no, I think if it's going to have any function at all, Twitter should probably be spreading love rather than hatred. But so yes, I hope I've managed to avoid it. A couple of times I've come awfully close, but so far so good.
Indeed. One of the things you said recently which intrigued me was, and I quote, "My love for Gogglebox knows no bounds."
It's true.
Now, that surprised me.
It did, really?
Yeah, it did. I didn't expect you to be watching Gogglebox.
I'm absolutely transfixed by it.
Yeah.
Are they the Siddiqui family or Siddiq? Siddiqui, I think. Mm-hmm. I just find I can't look away. I just think they're absolutely compelling. And what I love, one of the things I absolutely love about it, is the fact that there are sort of universal reactions that everyone, particularly television broadcasters. Assume that the audience is now fragmented into these little pockets of people who only are interested in certain things or have certain views. Well, that may be so to some degree, but there is also this tremendous... there are these sort of universal qualities of good humour and patience and humanity, which are present wherever you look and where you think people are going to have massively different reactions to something. They actually don't. That they all respond, whether it's a political broadcast or a reality show or whatever it might be. There is a sort of there are certain sort of universal truths that people cling to, and then by and large they're incredibly kind and funny and humane. And I actually find it very inspiring. He finds Gogglebox inspiring. My God, that doesn't sound good. I know, but I actually do. I find myself just liking them so much. I just like the people.
Well, in the interest of a cracking segue, you're on Gogglebox quite a lot these days. I mean, you're in Feek at the moment?
Oh, yes, I am.
Is that a run that's going to be a long run?
I am in the next five episodes, I think. So mm-hmm. In the next month or so. Mm-hmm. Up until the end of their season mm-hmm. four. Mm-hmm. And then they're not sure yet about the precise lineup for season five, but I had an amazing time mm-hmm. doing it. It was something I wouldn't have missed. I mean, it is absolutely astonishing. That woman, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, is just extraordinary. We will look back and say we were lucky to live in the time of Julia Louis-Dreyfus. I do believe she is just extraordinary, like no one I've ever seen. And to be able to be part of it, to have the sort of the best seat in the house, it was an incredible privilege. And so I'm, you know, fingers crossed it'll continue, or they'll find some use for me. Or I might look at the next script and see that I get assassinated or something, or I get cholera.
That would be interesting. Yeah. What a development! And you're also shooting the Night Manager at the moment, or have you finished with the Night Manager?
No, we are almost exactly today. I think might be our halfway point.
Okay.
We're shooting that in Morocco at the moment. Then we go to Spain for the for a big chunk of the second half of it. Absolutely, that's a project that's been dear to my heart since the novel came out almost 25 years ago. Back in the days when I actually imagined myself playing the stud, I am no longer the stud. I'm now the moustache twirling villain, but it's still a wonderful, wonderful experience to actually see this thing come to life. Because I've loved the book since I read it a quarter of a century ago.
And you said again to Craig Ferguson that it takes you about 10 years. To watch something, to be comfortable with something that you're in and actually watch it.
That is true.
How true is that?
It is true. I don't know if that's just sort of a pathetic kind of actorish vanity that I just sort of... that a 10-year-old version of yourself sort of doesn't look so bad in comparison to what you see in the shaving mirror now. Maybe that's partly it. But also I think you need that amount of time to get a sort of perspective on something. For some of the wounds to heal, you know, all the mistakes you're very conscious of, you know, the next day or the next week or the next year, you still remember the mistakes you made. But I think 10 years later, you can go, I actually don't remember the mistakes, and I can see this for what it is, which is occasionally pleasing and satisfying to look at. Not often, but occasionally.
So you'll be able to watch yourself in Feep in 10 years' time?
I think so. Okay. But not before.
Not before. Awesome. Hugh, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. So likewise.
And as you know, this week's podcast is sponsored once again by Squarespace. And here to explain the science behind Squarespace is Mr. Ali Plum.
Yes, it's Science Bit time with your friendly local regular editor, Ali Plum. Squarespace, of course, is the fun and easy way of creating your own personal website, portfolio, or online store. And guess what? You get a 10% off code with Empire. The word to put into the coupon box is Empire. Empire. E-M-P-I-R-E. It looks professionally designed, no matter what your skill level. There's no coding required. Easy to use tools throughout. It's got state-of-the-art technology powering it to make sure it's secure and stable and not going to like fall over in the middle of the night. It's trusted by millions of people and some of the most respected brands in the world, and it starts at just $8 a month. You can work it out. I think about £5 is about right a month, and you get a free domain if you sign up for a year. So start your free trial today with no credit card required at squarespace.com. When you do decide to sign up for Squarespace, remember Empire is the offer code, 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, as they say, build it beautiful. Thank you for listening not only to this Science Bit, but to the podcast generally. Please enjoy the rest of your regularly scheduled program.
I'll start the review section of the show with Tomorrowland, A World Beyond, as it's now known over here, because apparently of a music festival called Tomorrowland, which, in case people get confused.
I didn't know that.
That's apparently why it was changed over here to that, frankly, terrible title.
Slightly unwieldy.
Yes. Mm. But let's just call it Tomorrowland for the sake of the review. Ali, do you want to talk us through this one?
When you were talking with Hugh Laurie, did you set up the plot of the film in any way?
No.
Okay, so we can just start afresh.
Yes.
Right. Well, this is the tricky thing about Tomorrowland. It is, of course, based on the theme park, not ride, but area of Disneyland. And it has that element of Disney-like wonder at the future, that 1950s feeling of, isn't everything great, or won't it be great when we have jetpacks and rocket ships and all those awesome things that you thought you might have in the Jetsons? It has that sense of nostalgia about it. But it's essentially the story of this girl, played by Britt Robertson, who gets given a pin, or a badge, we might call it in the UK, that transports her into another world. And this other world is Tomorrowland. We don't know much about it, what the deal is, but when you look at it, there's a fantastic world, as I mentioned, of jetpacks and all that kind of stuff. Beautiful buildings, kind of like atom punk fun. Exciting, right? Mm-hmm. Well, it's not all fun and games, because somebody who used to be in Tomorrowland and no longer is George Clooney's character, Frank. And he lives in this kind of teched out house, blocked away from the world, nowhere near Tomorrowland. And there seems to be a mystery around why somebody who was in this wonderful, great place of the future has now come back to Earth and is sullen and grumpy and doing curmudgeonly George impressions. Those two get together, find a way somehow to find the mystery, uncover the mystery of Tomorrowland, what it is, what it was, what it will be. And as part of that, Hugh Laurie's character is the Walt Disney-esque, maybe bad guy, maybe misunderstood guy who's in charge of Tomorrowland. And of course, we go on to meet him and discover what it's all about. Directed by Brad Bird, co-written by Brad Bird and Damon Lindelof. It's a twisty-turny, quite involved film, which I think is a touch more cerebral than your average children's film, if you want to call it that, that comes out most summers.
To borrow respectfully from Shane Black, I think Brad attacks his work with a certain exuberance. And I think that's the main thing about this film that comes out for me, is there's so much energy, so much enthusiasm that he throws into it. It is very wide-eyed, you know, it's optimistic, exactly as Ali says. The problem is George Miller has ruined the summer. And once you've seen Mad Max, no, don't look at me like that. There is a parallel I'm drawing here, which is that Tomorrowland is all about, you know, it's wonder, it's invention, it's all about dreamers, as they say in the film. But there's more invention in a quarter mile stretch of Mad Max Fury Road than I would say in the whole of Tomorrowland. I think
I'm
that's.
I'm going to disagree with that.
Well, go for it. Disagree away. My main thing is it doesn't have that level of invention. And I think part of that comes from the nature of practical effects, is that they require a level of imagination and creativity that you don't get when you're relying on CGI. And it just felt, certainly to me, that Tomorrowland, there was nothing there I hadn't seen before. And I felt maybe there's one particular standout sequence in, which is absolutely wonderful. Those of you who've watched the most recent trailer will have seen a lot of it. And had the whole film kind of continued at that pace, it would have been an absolute masterpiece. But for me, without that level of invention throughout, it didn't quite fire on all cylinders.
It's a funny film. I felt after I watched it that I admired it more than I actually enjoyed it.
Mm.
And it's a difficult thing to kind of summarize or appreciate or write down how you feel about, because it's all about giving things a shot, having the big idea, putting yourself out there, thinking, what if I did this? And that's how great things are made. Now, I'm not saying this movie's a great thing, but it comes so close. I mean, it tries so hard, like you say. It has so much enthusiasm behind it that you want to forgive it all its flaws. You want to say, yeah, so that's a bit lumpy and setting up that plot thing is okay and that's a bit rushed in there and blah, blah, blah. And unfortunately, I didn't fully get behind it. I really wanted to. I thought there were some really interesting big ideas that I wanted to be like, you know what? I'm glad I'm seeing this in a film. This was otherwise would be hidden in a book somewhere.
Yeah.
And you've made it palatable. But it didn't quite deliver for me. It felt like a movie that had changed as it was being made. It felt a bit mutated, a bit twisted. But there's stuff in here to enjoy. It's just, bizarrely, for a movie which is basing itself around the fact that you can't talk about it because it's full of secrets and spoilers, it still managed to missell itself. I think it's still ported to be more about one thing when it isn't. I know that's just vague, but it's all I can do.
I know, that's just marketing. Yeah. I think that was intentional on their part. Perhaps a little cynical, but Chris, go on then. Disagree away.
Well, no, I disagree away because I think there's one sequence in this film alone that had
all the
astonishing,
invention.
Boundless invention. Yeah, and there's a home invasion scene, which is largely now seen in the I think the third trailer for the film. And that was the scene that they showed at the New York Comic Con, which I attended last October, when I spoke to Bird and Lindelof for the first time. And I came out of that Comic Con bouncing. And I thought, because no one knew what Tomorrowland was at that point. It had been shrouded in secrecy, as these things often are. And I just thought, oh my God, this is symptomatic of the rest of the film. We're in for an absolute treat. This could be a genuinely great film. Sadly, it isn't. But I will say that there is enough invention in that and in another sequence that takes place later on that I will not spoil. That I think there's enough going on here. This is a film that it does not suffer from a lack of ideas or a lack of optimism or a lack of heart. And I think it has all these things. I think it's a bit of a muddle at times. I think it's a little bit messy, but it tries something different and I applaud it and I admire for that. And it is good fun. And Clooney is very, very good. Britt Robertson is also good. Is sort of, you know, you may have seen her in some stuff before. If you watch Under the Dome, she's in that. But I think she's fine here as a very precocious 17-year-old. I think there are mistakes that we will get into, I think, in depth in the spoiler special podcast that we are doing. Once again, going back to my mantra, we interviewed Brad Bird and Damon Lindelof, so we have a spoiler special dedicated to Tomorrowland, which is out next week. But yeah, this is a movie that I had fun watching it. I think it's fine. It has somewhat dissipated for me since then. I saw it immediately after watching Fury Road, by the way. And I didn't think it suffered in comparison.
Interesting.
At all. But yeah, I think this is a fine movie. And as we say, as Ollie Richards, who wrote the review, the 4-star review, said in a tweet recently, you know, movies that swing for the fences should be applauded. And it swings for the fences. It doesn't quite get there. But I think there's enough here. And it's interesting. It's aimed at a different audience. It's aimed at sort of kids and teenagers and people. And I think it's not necessarily aimed at Brits either. Disney is a very interesting thing. And the idea about Disneyland and Disney as a person and as an inspiration, I don't think translates to Brits. The most we knew about, when I was growing up, Disneyland was a place that was just, I guess, a bit like Tomorrowland. It was just, I was never going to visit it. I didn't know what it was. I didn't buy into the Disney ethos. And I think that this might communicate itself better to Americans. Who knows? I will also say one quick thing before we go into the very, very quick roundup, because literally people are banging on the glass now, and David Hasselhoff, I'm not kidding, is about to arrive. But so we can't give the other films, sadly, the space that they deserve. But I will say one other thing is that I've already seen the way that this is going on the internet, and I see that Damon Lindelof is going to get a lot of the blame for this movie's shortcomings, and I don't think that's fair. I will say that. I think this is a true co-authorship between himself and Brad Bird, and I think it's the easy way out, it's the lazy way out to say that Damon Lindelof is the author of the flaws of any of the films he's involved with. I'm not saying he's the greatest screenwriter in the world, but I think perhaps you should look deeper. Dig a little deeper before you start apportioning blame. But having said that, we gave this film 4 stars. I know you guys don't agree with that necessarily, but I kind of do. And I think it's very interesting. And to go and check out Tomorrowland, A World Beyond. This week, really apologies for this again, we've got the Hoff coming. I'm not making that up, he's about to arrive. So there are 3 films this week. It's kind of a horror trilogy, if you will. There's the fantastic American/Iranian vampire movie, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, which is tremendous. Our Ian Freer gave it 4 stars. And I think it really marks... it's dark, it's atmospheric, it's got a weird sense of humor, it's got a skateboarding vampire. Quite frankly, I don't know if you want anything more than that. And I think it sparks a really interesting directorial voice in Anna Lily Amirpour, who's the writer and director of the film. So go check that one out. 4 stars for A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. There's also a really interesting sort of American body horror called Spring, starring Lou Taylor Pucci, which we gave 4 stars to as well. Probably the least you know about that, better going into that one, but that's also very, very good. And then it's the remake of Poltergeist, which we gave 2 stars to. 2 stars for the remake of Poltergeist, directed by Gil Kenan, produced by Sam Raimi. Sam Rockwell's in it. That's about as good as it gets. Sam Rockwell's presence is sadly a tired retread of all the best bits from the first movie, which doesn't really understand what made the first movie so terrifying in the first place, which is pretty much par for the course when it comes to modern horror remakes, but there you go. So yeah, go see Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. That's probably film of the week. Spring's also very, very good. Tomorrowland, really intrigued to see what you think, but do listen now for a spoiler special where we'll talk about it in more detail. And Poltergeist, sadly, the runt of the litter. Sorry about the monologue there, but time is against us. That is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined for the fourth time, I think. This is the first person to be on the podcast four times. Simon Pegg, who will be here to talk Man Up. And for the first time on the podcast, a man I've been trying to get into this booth for 3 years. He's remained elusive, and hopefully we're going to pin it down next week. Peter Serafinowicz, who's the star of Spy, which is a Shaun of the Dead in space reunion, of course. So they won't be in the same room. Okay. There you go. Until then, it is goodbye from James.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Ali.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to audition to become the new Stig. I've even brought my own helmet. See you guys next week. Bye.